In contrast to the high-handed way in which the DOE and the CDC and other agencies, health state agencies, have conducted health studies on people that themselves felt injured, whether these are Hanford downwinders or atomic veterans or you know, during the investigation of the experimentation using radiation on prisoners and others that finally came to light, it's the same pattern. You find some experts and you study the people as if the people basically are only objects. That's been the tradition, and it still is basically the tradition of health research. In other words, in order to achieve this presumed, and I say clearly presumed, objectivity of scientific investigation, you eliminate not only the human factor, any influence of compassion or understanding of the people whose suffering you want to elucidate, but you also totally eliminate the social context, both of the population that you study, under what conditions did they live, what was the whole setup of power and influence and so forth. You eliminate all of these factors, plus, of course, you totally eliminate the questions of what drives the science, who pays the scientists, what are the prevailing unwritten laws as to what research will be funded and what is not. That's never been part of any discussion in public. That goes on usually behind closed doors, and often it's not even there that it is clearly articulated. It's it is a silently existing ethics, called ethics, that really is a dominating influence. It's a cultural phenomenon in a way, and you know, it's just the same as the social pressures that people feel that school children are already growing up with. They have to have these clothes or else they'd be really cruelly treated by their fellow schoolmates. And scientists who think for themselves and would criticize even the design that, say, an agency like, well, let's not take the DOE number, let's take an agency like the National Institute of Occupational Health, NIOSH, safety and health, that's the S, safety. An agency like that wants to study a certain area let's say health and safety in a nuclear plant or in a nuclear. They come up with their question, and they come up basically with what they want to see studies, and then they send it around to the universities, and people can then make proposals. But it's already predetermined what are the questions and how they want them to go about finding them. Now that already greatly limits the possibility of raising the question, is that really the important question? And is that really a fair methodology? Is this leading to more justice? Is this leading to any improvement of the life and the health of the people that we are supposed to study? Those questions can no longer be answered because they have already been predetermined. And that's basically what happened also in this study of the thyroid. And I'll come back to that. But so people that are outsiders and people that have been involved in the controversy around the effects of radiation are people like John Goffman, Alice Stewart, Mancuso, obviously, and several others, and more lately, people like myself, and so forth. And when at a meeting of Physicians for Social Responsibility, we wanted to create a group that deals with Hanford, a study group or an action group, whatever you want to call it. We did the opposite. Instead of us sitting down and saying, now, this, I think, are the questions that need to be answered, and we will design a study. We went to the people who are involved. So we went to our contacts with Downwinders and said, if a group of physicians and scientists who are concerned about your concern, who think you have legitimate reasons to feel betrayed by your government, you feel betrayed by the medical community, because when you raised questions about couldn't there be a relationship between your living downwind of Hanford and the multiple health effects, be it cancers, be it any number of other diseases, you always got the same answer. Oh, there's no way that radiation had anything to do with this. We don't know what it is, but, if you think it's radiation, there's something wrong with your head, basically. That was the answer. So we asked these people, if you find a group of open-minded and compassionate scientists who have the who have by virtue of the other work that they have done, either as physicians or as scientists, have a certain degree of credibility, what would you want these people to do on your behalf? That's a totally different approach, right? So, and we ask people, obviously, that have thought about it. Because if you ask just anybody out in Eastern Oregon, Eastern Washington, you can't expect to get a useful answer. Because most of these people know nothing about health scientists, know nothing about what is possible, what is not possible. But we ask people that have done an absolutely incredible job of self-education under the pressure of their own suffering and that of their families and their friends. And so from these people we heard, one thing that you could do is, or a two-pronged approach that you could follow is, one, let us know or write us a letter saying that our concerns are legitimate, that we can take to our physicians, that they cannot simply discount. Because here's a group of physicians and scientists that on the basis of their understanding of the science and the literature say there is a justified concern here. And the second is, instead of allowing all these people to tell us constantly that it couldn't be true what we observe, at least look at us. At least look at our health status and see what you find. So that was the basis of that research. It's an informal, in a way, it's not a formally set up epidemiological study, but it's an informal attempt to do a health survey among a population of people that basically are self-selected, which is also a weakness, obviously, but at least it gets you to the people and their concerns.
Prior to that, they were not even conducting studies with the... they weren't making observations of these populations.
No, because they have... And this is where we get back to the culture and to the power of yeah, you could call it brainwashing, basically, on a very sophisticated level. They have very strong preconceived ideas. And the preconceived idea is that the doses that these people were subjected to in the first place until 19, what was it, 86? It was complete secrecy that any radioactivity was released. So there was no radioactivity. So if these people are sick, that must be from other things, right? Couldn't be radiation. But even after they admitted that they even deliberately had doused the area with radioactivity, they still came up, well, those doses are much too small. Because we know, in quotes, from the study of the atomic bomb survivors in Hiroshima, who were subjected to totally different kind of radiation, but, you know, they never talked about that, and the ordinary people had no idea of the differences. What do they know, the difference between radioisotopes that are lodged in your body and external gamma radiation from an atomic flash? This is meaningless. So they told the people, but also all the physicians and everybody, because they have the power, they have the media, they have the textbooks, they have all the government produced or financed glossy pamphlets that go out to the health departments, that go out to the clinics and so forth, that these people claim they are sick, but you know, we know that that can't be related to radiation, because we haven't seen any of that in among the A-bomb survivors.
They market a
point of view, and they couch it very, very cleverly in what sounds like scientific jargon. And it is an abuse of science and scientific jargon, but nevertheless, you know, you can tell the truth and still tell a lie. I mean, that's just the way it is. You can say, for instance, we know of no research that shows any relationship between having been exposed to radioiodine and a possible effect on, let's say, miscarriages. Let's take that example. We know of no research. That's true. But it is an infamous lie to a person who has had 3 miscarriages. Because they never looked whether there could be a relationship. They never did any study that would even come close to answering the question. So now you know what I mean by telling the truth and at the same time telling an infamous and really damaging lie to the people that ask these questions. And that's what happened in this field all along, and it still happens. And unfortunately, I have to be very direct on this. The announced result of the Hanford thyroid disease study from the Fred Hutchinson scientists is in the same category. To say that we see no evidence of any relationship between thyroid disease and radioactive iodine-131 is exactly the same truth, which is an infamous lie. Because the study was set up in such a way that the question they asked was more or less a self-fulfilling prophecy. So what they saw has nothing to do with how they interpret their study. What they saw is that a little more radiation or a little less radiation or a little less contamination with iodine-131, presumably, and again I say presumably, didn't make any difference. Now that doesn't, in the first place, that doesn't mean, even if that were true, it doesn't mean at all there's no effect. It just means that maybe the effect doesn't change with radiation dose, because they didn't look at what really they had hadn't designed that study to include a sufficiently large control group so that you could see whether a totally unexposed population and a population that was even only slightly exposed to iodine showed any difference. And then we come back to that study in a moment later, because inadvertently they have a control group. Inadvertently. And they totally ignore it in their public relations, outpouring, both in their executive summary and in the 200 and whatever number of pages complete report. It's, you have to go in there and look at the numbers, and you find that their own data contradict their public conclusion. And that, to me, is the lowest point of scientific unethical behavior. And I would say that right into the face of Dr. Hamilton and Dr. Davis. And they know it. They must know it. If they don't, then they're really incompetent.
By controlling the study's design, they were able to control the findings. Yet even within this attempt at controlling, they
slipped up, if you want to. If you want, I don't think so. I think it just happened. Yes, their design was not an. You know, it's again, it's a basic attitude about how do you do science. Now, the way I, as a physicist, was trained, you don't totally prejudge your conduct of a scientific experiment. Now, it's very difficult, of course, and questionable whether you can even make the comparison between a physics experiment and an epidemiological study. But I'm not talking about the nitty-gritty. I'm talking about the frame of mind. The frame of mind of a true scientist is that, all right, all of us start from a certain idea, a hypothesis. And that depends on your cleverness, and that's what distinguishes a genius from people that just do the same thing over and over again, what other people already have done, and make a career out of it. The genius lies in having an intuitive approach that is educated by a knowledge of the field, but it is still intuitive. But it is educated by what are the open questions in this field. And so let me design my study, and that you cannot really call anything other than intuition, in such a way that I ask the most crucial, most important questions. What the Fred Hutchinson study did was not ask the crucial questions. Crucial question would be, let's identify people that have thyroid disease, and let's see what we find. Let's ask them all kind of questions. Make it open-ended. Inquire about their history, their medical history. Inquire about other things like, because the literature has shown already when they conceived that study that there were questions about relationships between thyroid disease and many other things like birth outcomes. They could have known about it if they really had educated themselves. So when you spend millions of dollars, tens of millions of dollars, and you already go through the trouble and identify a cohort, then you try to get as much information from these people that you can. And you don't have preconceived ideas in advance of what will turn out to be important and what will not be. Because you don't know. You first look at all the data, and then you see whether any pattern emerges or whether any really new questions arrive that you didn't even think about. But here they are. Here are some trends, here are some numbers. And they failed to do that. So that already is a truncation of scientific research.
In this study, this Fred Hutchinson study, there was apparently no attempt at any kind of rational objectivity going into it.
Let me put it again in the framework that I said it before. This study was approached with a narrow-minded set of preconceived ideas what radiation would do. The ideas were totally limited to the mainstream point of view of what radiation can do to health, which did not include a clear distinction between internal radioisotopes and external radiation. It accepted as gospel truth the interpretation of the A-bomb study as being the only really great and valid study. And it assumed on top of it that because it was found to be true for such illnesses as cancers, that radiation and effect should be related by a linear, a proportional relationship. They made that assumption. And so they said, well, we can see whether radiation has any effect by comparing people that were exposed to less radiation and more radiation. And because they had these preconceived ideas, they got the answer. They found it didn't make any difference. But it never entered their mind that A, the doses that they assumed they knew for these people could be totally off, and those presumed categories in which they put people may be scrambled because the dose estimates that they had, and that's one of my particular problems with the study, these dose estimates may be off for a large number of these individuals by factor 10, or maybe even more, which means that people that are put in this dose category actually should have been put over here if they knew what the real doses were. They have no idea. There is absolutely no validation on a objective criterion like, say, biological dosimetry, which is possible, at least for certain dose ranges, that the doses that they assigned to the individuals that they investigated have any reality. It's based on a model that is the header model, which already has hardly any validation by itself, and that is only the first part, namely the distribution of radioactivity over the area. That model has serious flaws. That model doesn't take into account even such obvious things as the topology of the countryside. And if you talk to any farmer in the arid areas of eastern Washington, Oregon, they know that locally precipitation can differ by enormous amounts. Now, if precipitation can differ, then radioactive deposition, which is not only related to precipitation, but to wind and to many other factors, humidity, will vary even more than precipitation. And there's nothing in that model, in that header model, that takes that really into account.
So in one area,
it's a flat earth model.
I see. One farm, on the same farm, you could have one corner of the farm having a very high dosage, and like 20, 30 yards away, be much less.
Exactly. Exactly. The fluctuations could be very large, and it depends just from where the grass was that the cows ate today or for a week, And next week it may be totally different because the wind has changed, the humidity has changed, the temperature has changed, and the microclimate has changed, and it changes constantly. And any of these computer type models has only a credibility if it is checked, validated by actual measurements of deposited amounts. Now, they did some of that. They have measured the uptake of iodine in sagebrush. But the uptake of iodine in sagebrush, being a very different plant than grass, doesn't necessarily mean that what is taken up in sagebrush can be easily transformed to what was taken up by the grass that the cows ate. So the model is full of widely unknown factors, and it's one unknown stacked on the next unknown. Then you talk about all this detail of how much grass the cow eat, how much gets into the milk, how much milk did people drink, and they all had to remember 50 years ago where they were, what they did, how much milk they drank. So again, you got a spectrum of uncertainty there. And so what I think is, in the first place, that's exactly what I would have expected from a very poor dose model, that you just get an average. And so you don't get a trend. You get a flat within the statistical uncertainties of each of these points or doses, average doses in their categories. But it also could be, even if they had accurate doses, which they don't, they could still find a flat response if, and this is not at all a wild-eyed hypothesis, if the first small amount of radioactivity has a very large effect and any additional radioactivity has lesser and lesser effect. In other words, on a graph, something, instead of going linearly like that, it could go very steeply up and then bend over. And if you have a lot of error, you wouldn't even be able to see that initial slope. You just see the top. And it has, because of the uncertainty, you couldn't distinguish it from having a very, very, a very shallow slope or no slope at all. So there's this question. Is the uptake of iodine 131, does it have to be linearly related to the number of cases of thyroid nodules or hypothyroidism? Not at all. As a matter of fact, it is more likely that it is nonlinear, because it's not what scientifically you call a stochastic effect, an effect that is purely dependent on, you know, like a chance, like rolling a dice. That is the case for illnesses like cancer, where it is based on a mutation. Now, that has been shown to be a stochastic effect. That's, you know, you either get a mutation or you don't. But with other diseases, this is not at all the case. And therefore, the assumption of a linear relationship is another hypothesis that is not supported. Actually, it's very unlikely. And I would say there's a lot of evidence, as I have shown in publications that I have in the literature, from an overview of the total literature, there's much more evidence that for many radiation effects there's a supralinear relationship. In other words, where the initial increase in the effect with a small dose is much greater than at higher dose.
Say that again, the superlinear effect?
The superlinear effect simply means a graph that looks like that. This is a linear. Mm-hmm. This is a superlinear.
Okay. So low dose can have very high effect.
Exactly. In other words, if you look at, let's say, the increase percentage-wise of the effect, which is in this graph, is the slope, right? Mm-hmm. This slope is much steeper than the slope here. In other words, if you already at this dose and you add extra dose in the effect, you don't hardly see it.
You don't get much more effect.
But here,
at a certain point, yeah.
If down low, you get a very large effect for a very small increase in dose. That's basically what I'm saying. And there is radiobiological evidence for certain biological changes on the cellular level that showed this kind of a very strong non-linearity, and there's even some evidence in the ABOM study, which they also have not looked at, but we have published. And all of this is totally disregarded. And that's what I mean. If you do a study like that and you don't include the possibility, even if you don't believe that it is likely, but you don't even allow the possibility that your preconceived ideas are wrong, then that's a very unscientific approach. And I think that's... And then, on top of that, by interpreting the study in such a limited way, the difference between lying and just misleading, becomes indistinguishable. So it's a seriously unethical way of announcing the effect.
A great deal of time has passed since many of these original exposures or contamination elements have entered into the biosphere in the Hanford area. Some of them, however, obviously very long half-lives, some much shorter. Have we become better at being able to detect their presence this far removed from the original entry point in time, I guess?
There's still very, very little information on small amounts of long life radioisotopes in the population that shows all this illness. This is a challenge to the science of detecting very, very small amounts of radioactivity. However, I think it would be within the realm of the possible, given our sophistication with detection methods, to look, for instance, for traces of long-lived iodine-129, which lives 16 million years. So it's virtually forever, right? Or there are many other isotopes that have likely been dumped in the environment by Hanford, plutonium and sure. Again, it is in the realm of, we know of no research that shows that people have these isotopes. But have they ever looked? No. So we don't know.
Again, do you think it's because they know what they would find, or they have a good idea what they would find? I know it's a speculation at this point, but is it possible that they know they would find that?
I'll answer it in a different way. I really think that most of the players, which are the scientists working for Battelle Northwest and the engineers and the health physicists, are not really so evil, scheming people. What they are gullible in terms of accepting what helps them to get through their day, through their job, not to rock any boats, not to ask any questions that might be dangerous. And it is in this question that you raise here, is in the same category of not telling Reagan of the Iran-Contra imaginations, because then he can deny, he can say, I know nothing of such a scheme, so you're all wet. And whether certain people in that field, and I would say undoubtedly there are some that are work in the nuclear industry on health effects, probably have at least a little bit of doubt that what they believe is the ultimate truth. But they also know that it's probably better not to stir, because it could be very detrimental to their career. And so let's not look. So it's more complex. They don't want to look because they don't know what they would find. But they wouldn't even want to be surprised that they find something that they don't want to find. Okay? So it's just like that. And there have been whistleblowers all over, and also there have been whistleblowers in the area of health and public health, and particularly among the workers. And how do we know that records have been falsified, and rules for the safety of workers have been violated just to get more output and more plutonium made and so forth? And what happened to all of these people, all of these whistleblowers, have lost their jobs. That's a pretty strong signal to people not to look where it might be dangerous to look. So you don't look, you look the other way. Now let me come back to our study, because it's of a very different kind. Now you see, this study, like the thyroid study and like these epidemiological studies that were funded by the DOE, Battelle Northwest, they're also studies that have elevated into an icon or into a creed that the only studies worth doing are studies according to a now accepted scheme of finding a dose-effect relationship, because that's the only way that you can prove causal relationship. Now, you define that way, then you cut off the possibility of doing any other kind of study. Now, when we approached our health survey, we didn't approach it with any idea of knowing whether we could, actually we knew that we would, according to that definition, never be able to prove that the things we might find among these people is directly related to radioactivity from Hanford. But you approach it with an open mind. So first of all, we look at our data. And we see that there's an unusual high number of thyroid disease, cancers, miscarriages. By looking at miscarriages, we see that there's a much higher number of miscarriages among hypothyroid women than among those that have not been diagnosed hypothyroid. If you have a scientifically inquisitive mind, you ask yourself, oh, that's an interesting thing. Why would it be? Now, you can't prove anything, but you say, hey, this is an interesting phenomenon. Those women that are hypothyroid have a higher rate of miscarriages than the others. Then you look in the literature, and you find, and again, it's totally forgotten, never mentioned in anything like the BFI or any other report, but you find that there has been research done, not funded by the DOE, but by independent people that have testified, for instance, before Congress at the time of the investigations about radiation experiment, that when they looked in the various islands of the Marshall Islands after the hydrogen bomb tests, the Bravo shot, and they looked, for instance, at miscarriages and many other things, but let me just stay with miscarriages because I want to relate that to Hanford. And you find that there is a clear correlation of the rate of miscarriages among the population on islands that are farther and farther removed from the atoll where the explosion was. You see a decreasing line. And they also had data of the miscarriage rate before. Now, that depended, obviously, on going to the people, asking them, and getting this information directly from the women. Now, that already in the official scientific protocol is something that was considered not to be scientific. You don't ask in epidemiology people about their own health. You try to find objective means. And that cuts out the whole issue of whether the individual isn't, if properly instructed, the best and because the closest observer of his own health. And a good physician knows that and makes use of it and asks you very, very detailed questions in order to get a clue of what's wrong with you. That's very different from what happens if you go to one of those managed care health clinics and you get a blood pressure and you get a blood test in the laboratory. You hardly have a chance to talk even with the doctor. You're just a number and a series of numbers, and then they determine whether you need an operation or not. It's another totally misconstrued way of using, quote, a scientific approach. It's inhuman and it's unjust and it's wrong in my book. So we go back and see that we find in our group of people more miscarriages among hypothyroid women. We see in the Marshall Islands a relationship between the fallout by distance rate and the number of miscarriages. They didn't do any laboratory tests on hypothyroidism, so we don't have that information. But if you see that, and if you find in the medical literature other indications that some other people in clinics that have irradiated people for various reasons, like this paper that I just showed you this letter on, find a relationship among people that have been irradiated with X-rays and various adverse birth outcomes, of which miscarriages is one, then you put two and two together, like in a detective story. And you said, well, we know that these people around Hanford were exposed to radiation. We know that in other places, people that were exposed to radiation had a higher rate of miscarriages. If it quacks like a duck and it waddles like a duck, it probably is a duck. So probably these hypothyroid women that have higher rates of miscarriages got their hypothyroidism from the emission of iodine-131. We can't prove it according to the standards in currently accepted standards of epidemiology. But it becomes more and more probable if our findings are consistent with several other findings. And there are many other findings. There's miscarriage has been observed among populations that were far away from the Chernobyl explosion in Greece or in wherever. I mean, I have a whole list of these. I don't have them all in my head. But I looked through the literature and I saw all kind of things that are consistent with what we find. And these were people that were exposed to fallout from hundreds and hundreds of miles away, very low doses, and yet they found effects. So you see, that's why I say if the thyroid study had been designed with this kind of knowledge in mind, they wouldn't have designed it in such a way that they couldn't even tell whether a small amount of radiation couldn't produce much larger effects, because they already thought they knew that it couldn't, because they had simply preconceived ideas. So that's the quality of this work, which is, in my view, 18 million of wasted tax dollars money. But a little bit of saving of this 18 million we can do by looking really at the numbers. And that has been brought out in this piece. If you actually look at their numbers, you find that there was a small control group, I forgot what the number was, in that thyroid study. 248 out of the 3,400 and whatever people that are included in their study, 248 had left the area before Hanford even started to produce. So they moved all over the country. Now, fortunately, they followed these people, they found them, and they gave them the same thyroid exams as the rest of them. So you have a small control group of unexposed people. They pay no attention to the fact that in every category of all the diseases that they investigated, nodules, cancer, hypothyroidism, hyperthyroidism, you know, everything. I don't remember how many thyroid diseases they looked at. In every category, consistently, the people that had moved out of the area had a lower rate of occurrence than if you take their cohort that was exposed. And I don't distinguish among doses because, you don't have to, since there was no difference. You can take the rest of them as one group, right? In addition, in three categories, thyroid nodules, hyperthyroidism, and hypothyroidism, even according to the officially accepted standards of epidemiology, the difference between the lower rate among the controls and the rest of their cohort in each case was statistically, that's a term, statistically significant, which just simply means that the probability that that difference is just purely due to chance is less than 5%, let's say, 5 in 100. One category, the one that relates to our paper, namely hypothyroidism, the chance that it is purely statistical, that difference, is 1 in 1,000. Now that's about as significant as you need to be. Do they say anything about that? No. So even that lousy Hutchinson thyroid study at $18 million of taxpayers' money shows that hypothyroidism is a significant effect of being a downwinder, according to the selection criteria of the thyroid study, which is having been born as a child and between 40 and 45 and so forth. And it is perfectly consistent with our very untraditional study, which finds that there is has been an epidemic of juvenile hypothyroidism, which means an epidemic of hypothyroidism among juveniles under 20 years of age in the Hanford population that we have identified, which is only about 800 people for whom we got response on our health questionnaire. So just because we don't have a control population, that doesn't mean that our data don't have a lot of interesting facts include, and it challenges our inventiveness, how we bring this out and how we can show that these are significant results. Now, what we did is, and a little bit inconsistent maybe with what I said, but okay, let's assume that the header model has some significance. And let me say what I believe it has. I don't believe the doses, but I do believe that the header model at least roughly can distinguish between counties that were more highly exposed in comparison to counties that were lesser exposed. Because we have this averaging effect, right? They didn't take into account the microclimate, so therefore the individual doses is nonsense. But on the average, over a larger area, I believe there's some significance to comparing Grant County to a county in up north or in Idaho or something. If we take that and we compare our cases of hypothyroidism in our population, then we see a reasonable agreement that we find relatively more cases as compared to either the total population of the county or as compared to our respondents in that county. A reasonable correlation, rough correlation, with higher and lower exposed counties. So that is a very important extra input to the story. We see a rough dose effect. Now, if the dose effect is the fetish that is used to bolster the claim of a causal effect, then we even have a little bit of that. Not very strong, but some. But if, on the other hand, causality is not only determined by the statistical games that are being played by epidemiologists, but causality can also be derived, and in my view even more strongly, by consistency among findings in totally different areas, among totally different populations, like I said, about the Marshall Islanders, about the people that were exposed to Chernobyl, then you say, how do you, the critic, come up with a better idea to tell me why there should be that consistency? You will have a hard time convincing me that that is just by chance, that, let's say, on the Greek islands, hundreds or thousands of miles away from Chernobyl, they found also an increase in... I'm not sure whether that's now true, but I'm just saying that as an example. An increase in miscarriages or in infant mortality. In Germany, for instance, they found an onset of a sudden increase in infant mortality as soon as the cloud from Chernobyl arrived. There are similar data from other countries. There are data that are point in the same direction among the Marshallese. Now, I grant you that the exposure of the Marshallese is not the same as the ones in around Hanford, and it's not exactly the same as the ones in Chernobyl. But certain isotopes were common. And who knows what is the crucial thing? We have no idea. We're still very, very much in the dark. And all we can do, if we are honest scientists, is to get as much information and approach it not with preconceived ideas. And that's what our attempt is about.
In your experience with downwinders that you've interviewed and surveyed and worked with fairly closely, it sounds like for quite a while now, are a lot of them still easily hoodwinked, I guess?
Yes, unfortunately. Because they are the products of a long tradition that didn't even allow to question the motives of their own government or their own politicians. It is so anathema to them. You know, I mean, that has been the tragic history, even more so, because we know a little more about it, of the people in Utah and around Nevada, to see that they have been lied to. That was such a psychological trauma for these people who were staunch patriots, who believed in the mission of their country and of their and of everything the atomic energy did to the security of the United States and so forth, to think that they have been the victims of deceit and experimentation without their knowledge is something they just couldn't handle. And I think to some degree that is true for many of the people living in the rural areas around Hanford. So it's only, again, a relatively small group of people that have maybe stronger personalities or have just a mindset that allows them to deal more with a better way of dealing with unpleasant questions that have become knowledgeable, who did their homework, understand what the science is about, not the details, but in big lines, know how it can be manipulated, have gone to enough meetings of HHIN or the Hanford Advisory Committee or the Hanford Health Effect Subcommittee, you know, and they know now that they can't believe people that come with PhDs from Harvard or God knows, but because they wear the head of the hat of CDC, that doesn't make them more believable, not at all. And these are, these people are often seen as troublemakers, obviously, but these are the people that have a right to be treated on an equal level with those Harvard professors. That, to me, is true democracy. And if you don't have that, then forget it. Don't waste any more money.